that's true, 'cause you got me, baby, I got you. Hey, I got you, babe. I got you, babe. They say our love won't pay the rent, for it's earned, our money's all been spent. I guess that's so, we don't have a plot, but at least I'm sure of all the things we got. Babe, I got you, babe. I got you, babe. I got flowers in the spring. I got you to wear my ring.
Ahoy, Vachon. How's the French say, Vachon? This is the Brown Briefly, where less is more, more or less, coming to you live over KVSH 101.9 FM, Voice of Vachon, your island connection. Please make us part of your day. And be advised that our assertions and views, which can modestly be described as progressive persuasion, do not in any way reflect the opinions of KVSH or Voice of Vachon.
And that was the voice of our founder, Brian Brown. And this is the voice of Chauncey Gardner, also known as Michael Shook, your host today for the Briefly. And I want to wish everyone on our crew here and our listener a very joyful and happy Groundhog Day. I hope it's going better for you than it did for Bill Murray in the film of the same name. And there's a ground. No, that's not a groundhog on the screen. I
it
see.
It looks like one.
It's furry there. Yeah. But this is a great day for me because I love the idea that this is a day that was in my mind, my fevered brain set aside to honor Rodentia, the order Rodentia, all around the world, because of course groundhogs are a wonderful part of that order. So that's a great thing. And it's also on this day in 1998, I attended my first rehearsal for the Tacoma Symphony Chorus, and we were getting ready to sing Beethoven's Ninth Symphony choral finale. So it's a stupendously big day. That said, we have much to discuss. Let me introduce the other members of the Briefly here. It's our usual wonderful gang. We have Kevin Jones from Indivisible Vachon, who has just been remarkable in his diligence and his work toward helping to elect progressive people, not just here in Washington State, but across the nation. Kevin, welcome.
Good morning. Happy to be here. Looking forward to a wonderful Groundhog Day and joining with the Brieflies to discuss.
I have a question. Do you know anything about the Senate bill? And I wrote it down here and somewhere in my pile of notes. I have there it is. Senate Bill 5204, our 34th district representative or senator there, Joe Wynn, is one of the co-sponsors of it. And it is a whole Washington health trust. And this is a Senate bill that would create a true health insurance plan for all of Washington State. Now, I don't know any of the details of it, so I have to go on the legislative website, I guess, and find that out. But it certainly sounds promising to me. Do you know anything about that, Kevin, or anyone else?
Well, we have an indivisible network now across the state of Washington, and several people are tracking legislation and sending out calls to action where you could get in touch with your legislator when a bill that you care about is on their desk, if you will. And we are indeed tracking that particular bill. It says that a healthcare, the bill establishes a health care coverage system that will ensure all Washington State residents can enroll in affordable health insurance coverage, providing an essential set of health benefits, including medical, dental, vision, and prescription drug coverage. And apparently also it eliminates some inefficiencies in the current system. So mm-hmm. That is, as you mentioned, Michael, Senate Bill 5204. And people can get more details on that by going to website leg.wa.gov, at leg.wa.gov. Go to the bills, search for 5204, and then you can actually submit a comment online regarding that bill, or even just say that you support it is maybe all you need to do.
That's great. All right, good. Thank you. Gail Kellner, welcome. You're our futurist author and poet and owner of a beautiful Springer Spaniel, I believe.
She is a Spaniel. I just wanted to say happy Groundhog's Day to everyone. My family actually celebrates this day. We've gathered for the last decade on Groundhog's Day, though we're putting it off this year due to the pandemic. But we have our annual family reunion on this day in lieu of gathering at Christmas when it's a little too hectic and busy. So that's been our family get together for a decade now. So happy Groundhog's Day to any of my family who are listening.
That's wonderful. I am so pleased. See, this is just warms my heart. That's a wonderful thing. We have another poet here on our crew, Lynn Kerrigan. Welcome, Lynn, the former shortstop, all-star shortstop, I might say, for the Dixie Debutantes, and transplanted from here to Georgia and now back again, and has actually been back here for a long time, let's face it. So she's a bona fide Northwesterner. Howdy, Lynn.
Howdy, I just don't sound like it. So I have three quick things to say in this introductory period. One
sure.
is for you, Michael. How much wood could a woodchuck chuck if a woodchuck could chuck wood?
Rodentia.
I love it.
Two, I wanted to say this last week, and I didn't get it in, but I wanted to honor Tom Suddeth, one of our Vashon Islanders, who made the newspapers on January 24th in the Seattle Times because he died of COVID, and he and his family wanted him to be remembered for trying to do his part and for telling everyone in memory of Tom Suddeth and all the others who died in this awful war. Let's all do our part to try to prevent it. It's a big family on Vashon, and I just wish everyone my sympathies and thanks for their courage. And the third.
That's very, yeah, that's a wonderful thing. I read that, and I read some in the Beachcomber too. Yeah, this is the kind of citizenship to me. This is true love of your community and citizenship that really comes to the fore in folks like that.
That's right. It's a small island and everybody's been wondering who the deaths have been. And because of their privacy, you know, no one has the right to know it. But I was impressed to see that they could, you know, serve the community in this final way. Thank mm-hmm. you, Suttis. The last thing I want to say just briefly is last week I also wanted to honor the passing of Hank Aaron, mm-hmm. Hammer and Hank, who I got to see in the Atlanta Braves many, many times. The most memorable game I ever saw was him and mm-hmm. Nolan Ryan from the Yankees, I think it was, who was pitching. It was the best game I ever saw. I can't remember what Hank hit that day, but the minute I saw that he died, having hit, you know, 700 and what was it, 55?
Yeah.
Yeah. And that he hit his winning, you know, Babe Ruth record winning number 715 on April 8th, 1974. And he got a lot of flack as a black man playing baseball in the South. I didn't know that because he never showed it. Mm-hmm. He played ball. That's what he did. And he was a wonderful player and a courageous man in the civil rights era. So thank you, Hank. We'll miss you.
Mm-hmm. I have a quick comment. I had the great opportunity and thrill to meet Hank Aaron back in 1966. He was in Vietnam on a USO tour. And he stayed with my unit for about 3 or 4 days. As him, it was Harmon Killebrew, Jose Torres. I'm trying to think of all. Anyway, there were a number of big-time baseball players. And I actually got to meet and shake hands with Hank Aaron, and I can remember very distinctly that he had a hand like a catcher's mitt. It was huge and and incredibly soft and very soft-spoken. And I had been in country about maybe 2 weeks when that happened. And so I said to him, so how are you finding it here in Vietnam? And my the colonel, who is my CO, started laughing and said, son, he's probably been here longer than you have. So anyway, I thought that was kind of funny.
That's a wonderful anecdote. And thank you, Lynn, and Truman, both for those. Again, it just comes to mind, here was a person who was had extraordinary athletic gifts, and so did someone like Ty Cobb. And Ty Cobb, the Georgia peach, some people refer to him as the Georgia rotten apple. He was a very abrasive person and frankly, not very nice, deeply racist, as many people of his upbringing and generations were, but that's not really an excuse. And I contrast that sometimes with a man like Hank Aaron, who extraordinary athletic ability and devoted himself not only to being the best baseball player he could, but to being such an outstanding citizen, to
right on.
Fulfilling his obligations to his community and to his nation, really setting an example for people everywhere of how to walk through life with some dignity and integrity.
Exactly.
I just can't say enough good about people like that. And in the face of horrific racism. So there we go. Thank you, Hank Aaron. Bruce Hallman is our guardian of the galaxy and our resident historian, and who keeps me on track for my many flub-ups about history. I remember one time I got, I think, the Magna Carta confused with something from the 1700s or something. And Bruce gently drew me back.
Welcome, it's good, Bruce. It's good to be here. Yeah, I just... the thing I love about Groundhog Day is the Bill Murray movie. It's the ultimate sort of optimist. No matter how screwed up things are, if you keep trying, you can get them right eventually. And so hopefully with this COVID pandemic and this sort of stuff up that we've seen from the past administration, hopefully the current administration will get it straightened out, and then ultimately we will have a Groundhog Day experience and sort of get it right. So that's my hope.
That's great. Yeah. Yeah. I look forward to, I think we are doing it. It's wonderful. We're only a couple of weeks into this administration, and I'm seeing from my point of view, a whole lot of positive things. Lastly, we've got at the helm of the controls there, our Zoom master of mixology, Truman Tex O'Brien, also known as the Montana Kid.
There you
welcome,
go.
Truman.
Thank you. Thank you. Hey, and you know, our whole show, we started the show with just a clip from Groundhog Day, which, like you, Bruce, it was one of my favorite movies. I really enjoyed it. And Bill Murray is such a sleazeball. I mean, from beginning to end, really. But we played the clip of him playing the piano, and which was really just terrific, I thought. Hey, I do have one question. It was a Senate bill. What was the number? Was it, wasn't 5204?
Yeah.
5204.
Okay. I just looked up SB 5204, and it has to do with prohibiting counties from possession of a dog based on its breed. I got the wrong one. I'd say something's got to be wrong.
You might make sure you're right in the right biennium.
Oh, that could be the problem.
Yeah, you may be looking up last year's bill, last session's bill.
Oh, yeah, you're right. It was 2020. Sorry. That
life
was confusing.
So complicated sometimes.
Yeah. Okay, I got it.
This is tough.
Kind of morphed into God knows what. So I understand that kind of error.
Well, here we are anyway, February 2nd in the year 2021. Emperor Trump is dead. Long live the emperor, or something like that. While it was wonderful to celebrate Biden's victory, at least for those of us who desperately wanted the orange hairball gone from office, I'm starting to feel like I'm trapped in a Groundhog Day that encompasses not just Gobbler's Knob, Pennsylvania, but the entire nation. Over and over and over again, just when I think that sanity has started to prevail, that day is light and night is dark, that I will finally not wake up to Sonny and Cher singing, "I Got You, Babe," I look at the news and find that not only has Trump seemingly tightened his grip on the rotting corpse of what passes for the Republican Party these days, but that, like a plague, as if we needed another one, Trumpism is everywhere. What, for the love of all that is decent, just, and good, will it take to break the spell this monstrosity called Donald Trump has over so many in our country? The phenomena of Jim Jones or Bhagwan Sri Rajneesh or even Jimmy Swaggart have, of course, many disturbing elements, elements of tragedy, and at least in Swaggart's case, comedic farce, but they remain localized, specific to their time and place, and those involved were a tiny fraction of the population. In contrast, this madness is everywhere, even in our little old town of Squim up on the Olympic Peninsula. It turns out that the mayor of Squim, William Armacost, is a bona fide QAnon psycho. Nationally, in the congressional race in Georgia, of course, Marjorie Taylor Greene won her district overwhelmingly. She ran unopposed. And she is another QAnon devotee who has gone on record, and this is just disgusting, who has gone on record that the mass murder of those children at Sandy Hook in Connecticut was a staged event to enable the government to take away guns. What is an appropriate response to such lunacy? Is the GOP looking frantically for a way to shut her off to one side or hide her until the next election and pray a sane person runs for her position? Is she regarded as a pariah? Someone not to be trusted with so much as a butter knife? Don't be silly. She was given a seat on the Education and Labor Committee. All this and more reflects the devotion that many voters feel for Trump. In a poll from last week, 81% of Republicans still, remarkably, hold a positive view of the orange one. I am more than a little concerned about where the nation is right now or what this might mean for us. What say the Brieflies? Speak up now, don't be shy.
This is Lynn. I will just mention there was an excellent article in the Seattle Times as an op-ed in the last few days. I've been rifling through all my notes here, and I'm sure I put it somewhere, but I remember it. Chris Vance, who was the former Republican committee chair of the state of Washington, wrote an outstanding op-ed that said that he thinks that if the Republican Party expects to survive at all, it needs to split, that parties have split into different factions several times, and he named several, including when the Democrats went to Whigs, went to Republicans, you know, in the time of Lincoln. And, you know, that factions are historically probably inevitable. I'll come back to Bruce at some point and ask him for kind of further elucidation about all this. But I think with the actions of the Lincoln Project, you know, some of the national Republicans who were also concerned about Trump and his legacy, and now state people starting to say, state Republicans starting to say, if we want to survive, we need to do something about the kinds of things you're talking about, Michael. Even McConnell said there's no place for lies and looniness. And it's the only thing that I've read recently that makes some sense. I don't know how possible it is, but it made sense to me. What do y'all think?
So this may be kind of a slow turning in a way there. I noticed that this morning Mitch McConnell had come out. The turtle sticks his neck out a little bit there, and is advocating for a different position. Bruce, can you give us some insight from a historical perspective there about the demise of different parties and things?
Well, yeah, I mean, America developed a two-party system early on, but there have always been third parties that have come into strength and have changed the two major parties. You know, and what we see is right now the Republicans potentially splitting into two groups, and what will the proof will, in the pudding will be in the 2022 election, you know, whether or not the Trump wing of the Republican Party can carry votes in the general elections enough to sort of maintain that, or will they decimate the Republican Party, and the Republican Party will end up shifting into something different. And the Trump wing will become a minor third party, like the Ross Perot party was in the 90s, 80s and 90s. And so it's sort of like, wow, you know, you don't know, but I see the Republicans at that turning point of having to define who they are. And the interesting thing about the American political system is with primaries, and particularly primaries that are limited to only people of a party, it gives, you know, it gives small minorities within that party inordinate power to select who's going to represent that party in the general election. And my guess, you know, sort of nationwide, I mean, there's certainly be places like the area in Georgia where Green is from that will probably may well send her back to Congress if she's allowed to take her seat, which she may not be. But what you'll see is that across the board, Republicans are going to respond like they have to Georgia. They've lost two Senate seats in Georgia because of the Trump wing of the party. They can't afford that. And so what you're going to see is moderate Republicans starting to come out and starting to be more vocal and starting to try and control the primaries. And 2022 and 2024 will be a real test of whether the Republican Party can hold together like it has been in the past, or will it fragment into two parties and the Trump wing become a minor third party and the Republicans try and build something different.
Gail, thank you, Bruce.
Well, I like to play with math a little bit, and you mentioned that some 80%, about roughly 80% of Republicans still approved of Trump. But if you just like take a, and then I'm using a very broad brush here with this, but assuming that the country is maybe 50-50 Republican-Democratic, something in that neighborhood. That still means that if you take that 50% that didn't approve, 50 plus percent who didn't approve, who put Biden into office, who, and then you add that 20% that is left over of Republicans that don't approve of him, you've still got a 70% majority. That's a very strong majority of people who do not think Trump is, don't approve of Trump. So it's a, you know, it's two ways of looking at the same numbers. And I think that it's important to understand that he is not likely to re-enter politics in terms of like a 2024 re-election campaign if he, or at least no chance of winning it at something around a 70% of people opposing him.
That's great. Thank you, Gail. So that's what I love about that. Here's a different perspective, and it's like, yeah, okay, that's a good way to, a good thing to keep that in mind. And Kevin, I'll call on you just a second. I wanted to say it's not just progressives or liberals who are saying, wow, enough is enough. We've heard from Mitch McConnell. But as I've mentioned before, Kevin Williamson, who writes a regular column, a contributor to the National Review, flagship of the conservative movement, journalistically anyway, and he had a column, I think about 10 days ago, where he just said, that's it. It's time for the Republican Party to disassociate themselves. And he said explicitly in it, so we lose some elections over the next 2-4 maybe even 6 years. It's a small price to pay, he said, for making the movement what he feels has a chance to still be a truly conservative movement and contribute something to the good of the nation rather than the kind of lunacy that we've seen. So that's a great point. Kevin, what did you have on your mind there?
Yeah, that's inspiring, Michael, that, you know, there's certainly a lot of people in the party who do view it as the grand old party, and it's been around, of course, for decades. And people see that there's a point of view that we may not agree with, but there is a point of view, and it's logical, and it's frightening to see that so many elements of that party have now gone to really radicalized thinking. You know, McConnell came out and said, right, it's a cancer on the party. I think what, you know, strikes me is what we've seen now is this sort of merger, this intersection of social media, authoritarian leaning president and the presidential platform in terms of going back to, right, why are people still hanging in there with him? Why do we have that 80% of Republicans? Leadership is more powerful, I think, than most people believe. I think that's why advertising works. You know, we say, oh, I don't. Yeah, I'm not really swayed by the ads. Well, you know, they're there, and things work when they're repeated often enough, when they come from a source of authority, people are willing to believe it. And in this case, it's startling to me that people are still willing to believe that this election was not won by Joe Biden and Kamala Harris. I saw some footage this morning where Ted Cruz is now backpedaling on his role and saying that, yeah, really, it looks like Joe actually won. It seems crazy that memories must be that short that people are willing to let people off the hook. Hopefully they don't in this case. I think it's startling enough that people will remember really what happened.
That's great. That's Gail.
I just want to jump in, and I never thought I'd be the one singing the praises of Mitch McConnell, I can guarantee you, but he was,
you and me both, right?
You know, he was the one back on January 6th that said it's time for us to have a shared reality and based in truth, I'm paraphrasing. And as you just mentioned, Kevin, he called the current proclamations by Representative Green as being, he didn't call her out in name, but that kind of thinking and that kind of information or disinformation as a cancer on the Republican Party.
That's, yeah, so, well, this is great. I'm, my spirits are lifted, not only because it's Groundhog Day, but this is a great little conversation here, and to get these other perspectives. I have to be careful sometimes that I don't get lost in my own burrowing into different news things, even though I try to read different stuff. And I burrow like a groundhog.
I was just going to say, speaking of rodentia.
Kevin, I did want to mention, Michael, that, you know, it's amazing. We see, you know, one of the attributes of the ex-president is his ability to divide people. And it seems like he's an equal opportunity divider. And the havoc he's now wreaking in the Republican Party is just one other example. So I think he just maybe points that at everything and everything he does, except his family. it's amazingly, it's sad, right, what the division, the politics of division can do to a country like America.
We're making that shift, by golly. Lynn, what have you got to say there?
Real quick, I kind of want to tie in another perspective that came from Charles Blow, who was in today's paper in the Seattle Times. He's a columnist for the New York Times who writes on social justice issues. And he was taking this era in a black power movement, kind of saying it's kind of now or never, because one of the things he points out, and I had to think about this a lot, is that, you know, with the Electoral College still favoring smaller states and less favoring states with huge populations, right, that we still have a systemic issue to think about in terms of equity in our legislature. In fact, he says, he uses these statistics in every talk. He said by 2040 or so, 70% of Americans will live in 15 states. You know, he's talking about migrations to jobs and cities, meaning that 30% left will still be able to choose 70 senators. And that 30% will be older, whiter, more rural, more male than the 70% who have fled to bigger cities. And he said, you know, that that was unsettling to him because it could perpetuate, you know, discrimination. It can perpetuate an outsized proportion of what is basically some minority states running the country. So there's a lot to keep in mind as we go forward. I'll be curious to see if Biden or the Democratic legislature, if they choose to take on the Electoral College in the next 4 years. Mm. I find that a real big issue that people don't really want to take on or deal with. So we'll see what happens.
Yeah, that'll be interesting. Truman and then Kevin.
I just have a quick question, and I guess it's primarily for Bruce. The haven't I recently heard that they are talking about maybe working with the Senate to change the more like the representatives, where there's a more representative of population? Is that something that, I mean, didn't I hear that somewhere?
Mm-hmm. You got to demute there, Bruce. You're mutified.
And Kevin can expand on this. But yeah, there are ways of looking at changing the representation. And New Zealand, for instance, totally eliminated this what we call the Senate, the upper house. A couple states, I think Nebraska and Wisconsin, have done that. And so there are some examples of how you can move to more representative government. Kevin, you might want to, you probably know more about that.
I think that's good coverage. You know, there's some things that in the Electoral College, I think we've discussed it recently about the National Popular Interstate Vote Compact, which basically would be an agreement by enough states that represent more than 270 Electoral College votes to have their electors vote in accordance with the national popular vote. That's challenging because the states that have not agreed to that are the same states that Lynn mentioned. So the other thing I found fascinating about Charles Blow, some of his commentary is, let's move back. You know, the flight of people of color, African Americans from the South in the face of Jim Crow, he is claiming needs to be reversed. Look at Georgia, look at the power we can have. Let's get those state legislators to change hands. Let's get those newly flipped legislative bodies in those states to go with the National Popular Interstate Vote Compact. Let's get rid of the Electoral College. for once and for all. So it's sort of just startling that these are like global, you know, national movements of people to get the kind of government that we want. It's also interesting that, you know, I retired from the Boeing company, but my job was headed to Oklahoma. And, you know, corporations find that it's expensive to live on the coasts and that they can relocate and, you know, not only hire people that they can pay less in some cases, but some people are also willing to move with those jobs. In Oklahoma, the Boeing company actually had to issue a revised dress code because of people, I presume, moving in from the coast who weren't quite as modest as most Oklahomans. So, you know, there are cultural shifts that can happen with corporations too. And maybe that will balance out that that division, you know, geographic division that we're seeing. Who knows? But Charles Blow is apparently talking about that.
That will be fascinating. And along those lines, now I read last week, I think it was in a... may have been in a New York Review of Books, may have been on Quillette Online Magazine, but that actually there is a movement right now of, just as there was that movement of Black people moving to the North after World War, I think right before World War II, and then afterwards, that migration, Atlanta is the place to be. It's thriving. And you've got cities like Houston, which is, we think of Texas as, you know, there's still a lot of our minds, at least mine, that image of the cowboy out there. Well, Houston is the most diverse city in the country. Now it has an extraordinarily diverse population. And it's thriving. So there's some really interesting trends there. Yeah. Really interesting trends. I'll spend just a few minutes on this, shifting gears here. President Obama, via executive order, reversed policies put in place by George W. Bush, who had in turn reversed policies put in place by Bill Clinton. And now Joe Biden is using executive orders to reverse the reversal of policies that Trump had reversed from Obama's tenure. Which leads me to ask, who's on first? Is this any way to govern? What the heck is going on with all the executive orders? And perhaps, Bruce, you could, again, clarify a little bit this historic.
Sure, yeah. I mean, executive orders have been around since George Washington. They didn't start really numbering them until Abraham Lincoln. And up until the Civil War, the number of executive orders were in single or low double digit numbers. Lincoln actually issued 48 executive orders, but probably the most significant executive order of all time, the Emancipation Proclamation. And then the first one to break 100 was U.S. Grant. He did 217 executive orders because of Reconstruction. Most of those were sort of ordering federal intervention in former Confederate states. But then at the turn of the century, all of a sudden you had, as the federal government was starting to emerge as more powerful than it had been in the past, you had people like Theodore Roosevelt, Woodrow Wilson, doing over 1,000 executive orders. And then during World War II, Franklin D. Roosevelt, 3,721 executive orders. And even Harry Truman with 900 and Dwight D. Eisenhower with nearly 500. And then they drop down. I mean, when you get to the modern era, sort of Ronald Reagan, 350 executive orders, Bush 166, Clinton 364, Bush 291, Obama 276, Donald Trump only 220, and Joe Biden only 30. So it's you look at the federal government steps up when it needs to, and executive orders for the most part are just minor kinds of things, ordering a department to do this or to do that or to change a direction. What's happened really since Reagan is that as things have become more difficult to work through Congress, executives have turned to using, presidents have turned to using executive orders as a means of proto-legislation, if you will. If they can't get it through Congress, they can order it. And that leads to that sort of back and forth. Well, it'll be this policy for this period of time. New administration comes in, they reverse that. And you know, that's because of where we are with a deadlock in the Congress. And it also leads to those sense of what many historians talk about as an imperial presidency. Because the second branch of government, if you will, if you look at the executive as the first branch, Congress is the second branch, you know, the courts is the third branch, the second branch can't get much done. And so it devolves to the first branch, the president, the executive, to essentially proto-legislate. And then it falls to the courts to determine whether those are constitutional or not. That's why so many of Trump's executive orders were overturned by the courts. So it's a function of where we are.
Mm-hmm. Boy, that's fascinating. And it's really fascinating to me to hear some of the sheer numbers of executive orders passed throughout the year. So again, this is great because it gives me a context to regard things as they are now, and I can stop having a cow about, you know, so many executive orders being thrown around. Lynn, what have you got there?
You know, Bruce, I think that was really well said. I appreciate hearing the history of it. I think the thing that's so basic that I didn't understand until I've been reading into it a little bit more myself was that a policy that a president puts in place is not legislation, and so it can be reversed. It's not, you know, enshrined in law, which only, you know, the legislature should be changing. I didn't really understand that the executive orders that the presidents were rolling out really didn't have long-standing guarantees to it. Mm-hmm. You know, it just felt like to me that executive orders were about sudden things that president wanted to achieve and he could do, but I didn't understand the link between how each of them could undo the other's policies so easily. Mm-hmm. But it's because it's not legislation. And I guess to me, there's some question about how that could and should be followed up. In other words, how does a policy then become legislation, or does it not? Does it just sit there, you know, vulnerable to change?
Well, the classic example is the Emancipation Proclamation becomes an amendment to the Constitution. Slavery is illegal. Simple as that. So it can be done. And it's been done in a number of cases.
And what I was going to say is, doesn't it kind of set the tone for the presidency? I mean, for the Congress to follow? I mean, like, if they say these are the ways that we want to do things, and then they can either legislate it or not, but it kind of sets a tone, doesn't it? Not for that.
There's the direction we're
good
going.
Point.
Yeah, exactly.
Mm-hmm. I'm going to indulge myself here a little bit in informing our listener. This is my last day on the Briefly. I can't remember how long I've been doing this. I don't know, 3 years or something? Or I don't know.
Five.
No.
Holy cow.
Can't be.
Time just gets away from us.
I've been here 3.
Oh, goodness. Well, there you go. So, first of all, special thanks to Brian Brown for starting this and for inviting me. Thanks to Susan McCabe for her work as station manager and for her contributions when she was on the Briefly, and to Kate Dowling, who does that work as manager now. A general thank you to everyone at Voice of Vashon. How wonderful to have this resource. And grateful thanks to my cohort of Brieflies. You have made me think, stimulated my brain to look at our society and myself from broader perspectives. You've informed me and you've got me laughing. Thank you.
And Michael, lastly, I bought you a present and I'm trying to show it to the team.
There it is.
This is a plaque for your garage.
It we're running out of time.
The only time you run out of chances is when you stop taking them.
There you go. Thank you. There you go.
Lastly, to our listener, wherever and whomever he or she may be, You've hung in there through my rants and pedantry, and knowing you had my back during my admittedly failed campaign for president, it just warms my heart. And I'm going to end with a song that that Brian asked me to sing one time. So, life is not a highway filled with flowers. Still, it brings a goodly share of bliss. When the sun gives way to April showers, here's the point that we must never miss. Though April showers may come your way, they bring the flowers that bloom in May. So if it's raining, have no regrets, because it isn't raining rain, oh no, it's raining violets. And where you see clouds upon the hill, you'll soon see crowds of daffodils. So keep on looking for that bluebird and listening for his song. Whenever April showers come along.
Woo-hoo. Thank you. Thank Fantastic. You. Thank you, Michael. It's been such a pleasure.
Been great, Michael. Well, you got to come back, though, as a guest, okay?
I'll visit occasionally, maybe.
If you have. Okay, Sparky will miss you.